Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
Hello, and welcome to another bonus episode of the Iditapod. I'm your host, Casey Grove, and coming up we have that interview, as promised, with Aaron Burmeister from Nome, where he's originally from. Mush is out of Nenana, however. Alaska Public Media's Jeff Chen recorded this with Burmeister at the Nome radio station, KNOM, about a day after Burmeister finished his 21st Iditarod. Burmeister talks about his plans to step away from the Iditarod, about how his race went this year, and how much dog mushing has changed over the many years he's been a competitive musher. Again, this is Jeff Chen talking with Aaron Burmeister. And Burmeister starts off talking about what it was like making that final run with his dogs on the way to Nome.
You know, last night finishing, it's always a good feeling to be coming to the finish line. And one thing that I've done since my rookie year in 1994 is I crest the top of Cape Nome, pretty much 11 miles from the finish line there. And as soon as you see the lights of town right before you start coming down the mountain, I pull the team over and sit and we have a little cry and just give everybody a snack and some loving and play with them a little bit and look at town and just kind of, for me, it's the emotions of realizing that another season, another race is behind us and finish line's 10 miles away. So this year we stopped up there and snacked the dogs and I'm sitting there and I had a small team, six dog team. That's the smallest team I've ever finished with, but they're a beautiful bunch and very close bonded team with me. And I sat there and visited with the dogs for about 10 minutes and thought about the race. And Chad Stoddard, a young man, he pulled up alongside me while I was sitting there and said, "Hey, is everything all right?" I said, "Chad, I'm just having my little time with the dogs. Go ahead." And he's like, "You're not going to race me to town?" I said, "No, no. I'm not worried about racing to town. I'm just having my own time with the dogs." And he said, "I'll follow you on in. Good job." And I gave him five and he went by. But it's that moment, and that's kind of when I take time for myself and the dogs before coming in and crossing the finish line, is just to reflect on the race, reflect on the year, reflect on life, and have that little bit of time with the dogs and then trot on into town.
That's incredible. I spoke with Chad earlier and he was like, "Yeah, I'm a pretty competitive guy." So I don't know, maybe he took advantage of that moment. But I don't know.
For him, it's not my first rodeo and it's his first real Iditarod, first time ever finishing in Nome. And he was just ecstatic. He said, "Aaron, I wasn't really even racing until I saw you up there." And he said, "Then I turned it on." I said, "Well, I wasn't worried about it at all." I said, I've ran this race and finished it so many times. I said, one place to the next isn't a big deal. My goal is to win the Iditarod and bring that victory home to Nome. And that wasn't happening this year. So we're just going to get the team healthy and happy and try to enjoy ourselves getting to the finish line.
Awesome. Well, thanks for that. You've been doing this for many years. Are there any particular special places along the trail, the Iditarod Trail, that you want to share about? Were there any places this year that really stood out to you?
You know, for me, it was a lifelong goal as a child to race the Iditarod, because Dad did it back in the 70s. My family's been very involved. I've been very involved pretty much since I was a baby, being here in Nome and growing up here. And for special paces on the trail for me, it's when we start hitting the villages. It's starting in Nikolai and then McGrath, and every community, every village, the people that come out, the elders that come out, just being a part of it. That's what's special to me, is traveling through those communities, seeing the people along the trail. Some of the volunteers that we have still working Iditarod today, and even at the remote checkpoints, places like Cripple and Roan and stuff, Terry Boyle and his wife that were out there in Roan that have been there since my rookie year. People that are a part of the race that make the event what it is. It's not just the Iditarod, it's an Iditarod family. And that Iditarod family is pretty special. So my favorite part is really traveling through the villages, seeing the people along the way and meeting up with old friends and making new ones as we go.
Awesome. I think I read in your interview with the ADN about how there's not something called retiring from a career in mushing. Can you share more about that? Like, what do you, are you done? I think you used the words quit too, but I wasn't sure if it was in reference to yourself or what.
Right. So, no, it's interesting. I got a lot of that started in KTUU in an interview back in January when I was on my way to Bethel. And the first question they asked me in that interview was, we hear a rumor that you're retiring from mushing. And I kind of laughed at him. And I said, dog mushers don't retire. We just quit. And I said, you retire from a career. If you work for a lifetime and you make a living at that career, that's what you retire from. Dogs and racing and mushing is more of a hobby that people spend a lifetime doing, and it's a lifestyle, and it encompasses everything, but it's not something that's going to pay all your bills and pay your mortgage and do everything else. It's something that costs you money. So you don't really retire from being a dog musher, you quit. And so, and I made very clear, I am not quitting dogs by any means. I'm just quitting racing. And the commitment it takes to race and be competitive at the level we're racing today is unbelievable. It takes time away from your family. It takes time away from your friends. I've got lots of friends and acquaintances and people all over, and somebody calls and wants to invite you over for a dinner or somebody's birthday party, or and it's going to be 2 weeks from now on a Thursday evening or a Friday evening. It doesn't matter, but you can't commit to it, because if the weather's 40 below the day before and you're not running dogs and it's 20 below that day, you've got to be on the trail running dogs. So your whole lifestyle revolves around training a dog team, taking advantage of the weather. If you've got storms, some days you're grooming trail for 8 hours that day with snow machine, putting the trails back in, and then you're running dogs for another 8 hours, so you're not done till 2 a.m. So it takes away from everything else in life, and you're 100% focus from pretty much October through the end of Iditarod is preparing yourself and that dog team at that highest level to do it. And if you're not on the trail, you're working in the kennel with the dogs, you're packing food drops, you're preparing things. My wife spends 2 to 3 weeks every winter cutting and preparing and packing and cooking meals. So we've got trail meals for training and trail meals for racing. And it's life encompassing. It's not something that you just decide to go do and spend a few hours a day doing it. It's a 24-hour-a-day commitment. And that's been my commitment to it my entire life. And with my family, and I manage a company called Tumen Industries, so I've got a very busy work season that I've got meetings starting this coming week, and barge orders and materials and estimating and getting jobs ready for the upcoming season. And it's a very intense construction season all the way through the end of October. And so you do that all season, and then you get a 2 or 3 day unwind period and break, and then you're back on the dog team all the way until March. And it's been a wonderful lifestyle. I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world, but it's busy. And with our son Hunter, 13 now, and our daughter Kiana is 9, and their lives have to revolve around what I'm doing as well, because it's such a big commitment. And they both got other interests, and I want to be able to focus time in our life on our family and things that my wife wants to do and what the kids want to do as well.
Jeff, can I jump in there real quick?
Of course. Yeah.
All that said, Aaron, I mean, if you don't mind me saying, you're at the top of your game. I mean, at 2015, you had a third place finish, and ever since 2015, pretty much all of your finishes have been in the top 10. You had the second place finish last year in the Gold Loop Trail, and it just feels like you're getting closer and closer to that victory. And I know you've talked about how much it would mean for you to bring a victory home to Nome. So I guess, is there anything else to say on that matter? I mean, I know it's hard to walk away without that victory, but do you think that there still might be a chance down the road, or what's your mindset on that?
You know, I'm trying. It's hard to even think about it. It's hard to look that direction because of the level of commitment it takes. And I really look forward to focusing on some other things. Yes, that little chip's going to be on my shoulder the rest of my life until maybe I attain it or maybe I won't. But that competitiveness in me definitely really wants to bring that victory home to Nome. That's been a goal since being a child. But a difference in my lifestyle is a lot of these mushers, a lot of these people that I'm competing against, their life, their everything revolves around dogs 365 days a year. Because I have a career, a large construction company that I manage, a real job and a family, I've got a lot of distractions. I can only commit, even at racing at today's level, 50% of my time to the dogs. Because from March until November, I'm away from my dog team training. So that little bond, I've never been able to give Iditarod 100% or my dog team 100% because of my commitment to work. My partner in Nenana, Tony Browning, who came on board with the kennel in 2012, has made it possible for me to continue racing since 2012 because I spend pretty much from March until November in Nome working and managing a construction company and keeping jobs and traveling to all our villages from the lower Yukon through the West Coast up to the Kotzebue region with projects all over the place and wonderful employees and a great staff. But that's my commitment to a career, to a job, to our community and our region of Alaska is kind of rebuild the infrastructure. And so it takes away from the dogs. And it's like a lot of people tell me that, man, if you ever focused on just dogs there, you would have won it 10 times by now. And I said, well, that's maybe true, but I'm focused on multiple different things and having that career and allowing Tony to take care of the dogs. When we walk into the dog yard, Tony's like dad because he's there raising the pups while I'm gone in the summer. He's the one they have that bond through. When he walks through the dog yard, they look to Tony at like dad. They'll jump on their houses, wagging their tails and playing, hey, dad's here. And then when I come walking through the dog yard, everybody stands up and salutes, and it's like, yes, sir. So they don't have that playful happiness when Aaron walks through the dog yard. It's like, uh-oh, here's Uncle Aaron, and here's the boss. So it's a whole different respect. And like Mandy or the kids go out and play with the dogs, and they're wagging their tails and playing and happy. And then I walk through again, and it's like, yes, sir, what can we do for you? And it's a different relationship I have with them now because I'm not there year-round. And but I do commit myself from when I get home from work from pretty much the 1st of November until Iditarod. I'm the one out there watering them, feeding them, scooping them, hooking them up, going for the runs. And so I have learned how to overcome that. It took me years of racing because it was a weakness I would have when I got to the coast. That last 25-30% of the trail, if you don't have that bond with the dogs, they're not going to give you that extra 20% competing on the way up to the finish line. And I'd always get to Uniclete or Shaq Tulik in the top three, top five, and I'd fall off and finish 8th or 12th or 11th coming up the coast because it takes that extra bond. And what I learned by 2014-15 is that to get that extra bond with the dogs, with me not living there or raising them from puppies and being there year-round, I had to spend a lot more time traveling with them in the winter. I had to spend a lot more time camping on the trail. So the intensity of my training and commitment of training to make up for the half of the year that I'm not there had to be a lot higher to get that bond and that respect from the dogs. So I do spend a lot more time traveling on the trail and camping with the dogs and living with them on the trail versus just doing day runs or shorter training runs. And that is a way that I found to overcome the weakness that I had by not being home year round. Cause I'm away from the kennel 8 months a year, November, December, January and February, I'm there with them and racing in March. So I've got 4 months to make sure that bond is tight from training and everything else to prepare them. So that's, excuse me, that's a weakness that I've always had to overcome. And it's something that if you can't give something 100%, it's hard to do. And if I'd love someday, maybe once I retire from my career, from working, to get back in dogs, but it depends on what my wife's interested in. The kids may be grown up by then, but shoot, I'll be a lot older. I'll be 10 years older then, and we'll just see what time does and where things go in time. But I love the lifestyle. I love the dogs, and this event has been a part of my life since childhood, and it's hard to get away. There's a lot of emotions for me on the trail this year traveling through the villages because people coming out, as they always do, to pay their respects and to thank me for being out there and being their favorite musher and following me along all these years. But at the same time, there's other things in life as well, I think, than Iditarod, and I'll have to explore some of those things.
Yeah, tell me about that. What's the Aaron Burmeister after Iditarod 2022?
Well, you have to ask me that next year because I'm looking forward to doing some other things. We have a young man that's been working with Mandy and Tony and I for the last couple of seasons in the kennel, and we've been coaching him up, and his name is Eddie Burke. And he'll have an opportunity to jump on this top-notch race team next year and represent the kennel and take what he's learned from us the last couple of years and be able to race the team. So we'll certainly have it. The dog team will still be racing. It just won't be myself on the runners, and it'll give Eddie an opportunity to do some learning and get out there and race. So we'll still have dogs, but my commitment to the race and to the training of them won't be at this level anymore.
Yeah, I'm also just kind of curious about the origins of your kennel and maybe if you are going to be rehoming any dogs or I know this guy Ed is going to, you know, be running them a little bit more. Can you just share a little bit about the future of your kennel?
So the kennel is something that that my mom and dad started back in the early 70s. They moved to Nome, I believe, in 72. Started working with Howard Farley, doing tours and stuff down at Farley's camp, and got into mushing. Of course, both my mom and dad are competitive people, and they both ran races in the early days. Dad ran the Fur Rendezvous in Anchorage, the local Nome Kennel Club races, and did the Iditarod in 1979 and 82. And of course, he traveled and ran races all over the state while he was doing it. Mom did a lot of the sprint races around. So I grew up racing it, and our old breed of dogs were really a combination of stuff they got through Howard and Julie Farley in the early days, and a lot of the Siberian breed. But as time evolved, he would breed into stuff from Isaac Oklisik from Teller and Herbie Nagpuk from Shishmaref, and it was a really tough old breed of husky. And we still maintain that, you know, going back many generations in the dogs as a base. But when I turned 12, my father was busy working on his dissertation and getting his PhD there for a couple of years. And I, you know, through childhood, I always would beg to spend time in the dog lot with him and be around the dogs. But he never let me feed them by myself. And I still remember the day I was 11 years old. And I begged him every day to go help him feed dogs. And that night he said, okay, you can come feed with me. And he walked around with me and let me feed the dogs while he was walking along pulling the sled with a bucket in it. And I fed the dogs for my first time, and I think he never had to feed dogs again after that, because the next night he was busy, so Aaron fed the dogs, and it was kind of took over. And I kind of took over the kennel at that point between the ages 11 and 12 and the breeding program and everything else. And a gentleman named Roger Roberts, the loafer from Ophir, lived up here in the late 80s and through the early 90s, and he kind of took me in as a coach and spent a lot of time working with me and coaching me through racing, as getting ready for my first Iditarod and junior Iditarods, and I ended up acquiring his dog team as part of mine in the early 90s when his back went out. So we incorporated his breed and bloodlines into our breed, and he had a very competitive very well-bred dog team, so we were able to combine that together and put together a unique bloodline of our breed and his. And sled dogs evolve over time. You breed for certain things, and one thing that Loafer had always instilled into me is, Aaron, we never breed a dog unless it's a leader. So you breed leaders to leaders. That way you get that drive, the smarts, and everything else. Don't go breed that dog because it's a pretty dog. You want to breed something that's going to improve the genetics, improve the program. And starting in the 90s, that became a rule of thumb. By, I think, 2000, I had made a new rule in the breeding program, is we don't breed anything unless it's proven. So it had to have finished Iditarod, and at least one Iditarod, possibly two, to be able to be a breeder. And so now you look at 30 years of breeding, that you've bred nothing but leaders to leaders, and you've bred nothing but proven dogs. That means their feet, their heart rates are lower, they're healthy dogs, they're good eaters, all the attributes we look for, we have good fur, and it's created a breed of dogs that have become a dominant breed in the sport. And it's kind of been a lifetime goal to build that kennel and build this breed of dogs. And the compliments I get on the trail from other mushers and people along the trail all the time are just a solid, hardy, incredible dog that we have. It's not something that just happens overnight. It's been a lifetime work.
Yeah, I think I noticed, I think you said like five or six of your dogs on your team can kind of run lead. Has that impacted your team in certain ways, or like do they just not want to be in the other positions, or like?
So, like I think I said yesterday at the finish line, I finished with six dogs, and five of those six are main leaders. So I wanted Dudley in lead and single lead this year coming down Front Street. And Dudley's a phenomenal trail leader. He can run through open water, glare ice. He'll do anything I ask him to do. And it's like I tell people, a good lead dog will take you to the moon and back because they trust you. If you ask them to go jump in the ocean, they're going to jump in the ocean because they trust you. And Dudley really stepped up in a big way this year. The one weakness he has is he's not good in checkpoints because he's bonded with me. He doesn't care for other people or people standing around or anything else. So one thing this year, and I did what I wanted him to do just to build his strengths, was to lead me in and out of a lot of the checkpoints and to build his confidence around people. And so it was a little bit slow when I first put him in lead and coming into Ruby, and he's real sketchy and questionable around the people, and he'd always go wide around him and be nervous. But as we went along, I'd always, if I had somebody in lead on the trail besides him, I'd put him in lead before the checkpoint. Not because he's a good checkpoint leader, but because I wanted him to become a good checkpoint leader and used it as a training opportunity. And he led me down Front Street this year, and he was a little nervous. He tried to go to the BOT crowd and all the people that were lining the roads, and he listened to me. And he went back to the middle of the road, and his confidence built as we came down the street. And by the time he got into the chute, he saw that finish line there, and he just charged right for it. So it really was fun for me to see his growth throughout the race, and from just being an excellent leader to a phenomenal leader, and picking up one of his weaknesses and making him stronger at it. And I had Charlie in the team. I had several other really good leaders in there that would have just charged me right down the street that love people. But I wanted to focus on one of Dudley's weaknesses and make him stronger at it, and use it as a training opportunity. And for me, I think the one thing that's kept me going in the sport is exactly that. It's training. It's watching that dog grow. That's why I love harness breaking puppies and working with yearlings and two-year-olds, because you can see the most growth in a dog in that first 2 years as they're becoming dogs, as they're learning their role, and you can shape them so much. And it's like a basketball coach that's working with a first or second graders. You're really watching that growth, and they grow by leaps and bounds. And it's one of my favorite parts of the sport.
Great, thanks. Back to the race. Were there any very low points for you, or very high points, or like cute moments with the dogs that you just want to tell everyone?
Yeah, you know, there's highs and lows almost every day. We go through them, and a high point for me every year is making it 20 miles out of Roan, getting to Farewell Lakes, because the whole race from the starting line on, and I think for me it's because I've done it so many times, I've seen Dalzell Gorge and Roan and the Buffalo Tunnels in the best possible conditions, and I've seen it so many times in the worst possible conditions, and so I'm a nervous wreck going into that first third of the race because I know how bad it can be. So it's always an incredible high point when I get to Farewell Lakes, past Egypt Mountain, out of the Buffalo Tunnels, with myself in one piece, the dogs in one piece, and the sled in one piece, because that's a very intense, wild, very technical part of the trail that's dangerous in a lot of ways, just for the conditions, and lots of open water, glare ice, bare ground, gravel, stumps. I mean, just a lot of technical stuff. And so for me, getting through that is a high point, and that and making it in one piece, and if camping just past it and evaluating the dogs and everything else, and that was good. This year it was kind of funny because I got out there beyond Farewell Lakes and there was no snow still. There was nowhere to stop and cook for the dogs to make water, because you had to go get, you have to camp, pick a camping spot where you have shelter, such as, you know, a windbreak, having trees around or something, a place to build a fire, and also have snow to melt water for dogs. And this year I had to go quite a ways past Farewell Lake to get to the snow, and I pulled over and camped, and it was 45 degrees out. The wind was blowing about 30 miles an hour, but we were below the trees, so it was just hitting us in gusts of 5 to 10 now and then. But I was soaked up to my knees because we had so much water crossings. But with that wind blowing at 45 degrees, I threw a piece of straw twine over a tree, and I tied it to another tree. I took off my snow pants, hung them up. I made a clothesline, took off my boots, hung them up, and hung my clothes up. And in 2 hours, all my clothes were dry because it was 45 degrees out, and the wind was blowing. It was perfect. It worked out great. I was able to leave that camping spot completely dry again and let Mother Nature help me dry everything out.
Laundry on the trail.
Exactly. So it was kind of fun and to be able to do that. You know, and other high points are coming and going through the villages and seeing people and visiting with people, but it also created low points. And a lot of my close friends and old timers that have been around dogs and mushing and have watched me grow up as a child, I spent a lot of time in Unicleet, you know, going to their Covenant Bible camp and everything. And the community really showed up in force to see me come in and visit with me. And that was a low point for me. It was emotional because everybody was asking questions. And is this really going to be your last Iditarod? And the same answers. I'm never going to say it's my last Iditarod, but certainly maybe for a while. But they were bumming because they said, well, we've got nobody to follow anymore. You've been our favorite musher for years and everything else. I said, well, I'm sorry. It was a very emotional point for me, visiting with all those folks. And, of course, I haven't seen articles yet, but I guess ADN put an article, and when I was going through White Mountain, somebody told me, Dad, I read your article in the paper, and I started crying. I said, what article? He said, oh, there's a picture of you on the front page of Anchorage News that you had tears in your eyes. I said, oh, no. So I'll catch up with all that here in time. But, yeah, that was certainly an emotional part.
What's your family think about your decision to spend more time back at home and not training as much?
I don't know. We'd have to ask my wife. I think the kids are excited because Hunter's already asking about getting snow machines out and going riding and doing things. And we haven't talked about it a whole lot, I don't think, at this point yet as a family. But I'm certainly excited to be able to do things with them and see what else is out there. Just enjoy things together as a family. But Mandy has been a super mom for years and a super wife because she's been there standing beside me for 23 years, supporting everything that I've done, and she still does. And if I was going to race Iditarod next year, she'd stand beside me and support me 100% because she's an incredible woman, and it's been a honor to be her husband and to have her as a part of my life. But I know for myself that there's other things that she would probably love to do, and the kids are very active. And like I say, with Mandy being a super mom, she's there at every single after school activity. She's making sure that the kids have everything they need all the time, and with the sports, with everything, and doing it all on her own without dad being there. And she's never once complained or never once asked me to go. She always lets me know when the events are and if I can get away or if it fits the training schedule. I'm always going to do that. But it's as simple as coming down to a parent-teacher conference. She tries to let me know 2 weeks ahead of time. They're doing parent-teacher conferences on Thursday and Friday. They have these windows open. What fits your schedule? And all the teachers know how busy I am. So the teachers give Mandy the opportunity to talk to me first to see what's going to fit Aaron's training schedule so that all the other parents have to work around my schedule too. I feel a little guilty about it. But that's kind of the story of our life because that's the way it is. And it's terrible for me to think that way, but that's the way people and it's the way life is when you're as busy as we are.
Well, do you have it sounds like you're working towards that balance of, you know, something, such an intense sport like Iditarod running. Do you have any advice for other mushers that are trying to navigate that balance in their life?
You know, my only advice to other mushers is don't get hooked on dogs because it's a lifestyle, and albeit it's a wonderful lifestyle, but it's all-encompassing to do it at the level that we do and to be a part of this event. And once people have done it a couple times, they're like, wow, holy smokes. And either you're 100% into it and love it and addicted to it, or you're doing it halfway. And anything we do, you got to do it 100%. You can't just be successful at something and do it halfway. I've been fortunate to be surrounded by people in my lifetime that have been incredible supporters and people that come help with grooming trails, people that help with training the dogs that make it possible for me to do it. Without Tony and Marion Browning, there's no way I'd have been racing the last 10 years because I wouldn't have had that expert at home working with the dogs, making sure they were taken care of, the fall training was done, everything else. It would be impossible for me to be here. So you can't do it by yourself. It takes a team of people to do it, and you have to have the support from your family, from your friends, and sponsors. I've got sponsors that have been with me, like Northerner Cargo, over 20 years, and they're a part of the family. They make sure you pick up the phone and you need something. They make sure it's taken care of for you. A QAP, a company I worked for 18 years, was Quality Asphalt and Paving, has been a sponsor for many, many years as well. And Bering Pacific Services, I mean, there's the family of sponsors that have become a part of our program that make it possible. And that's really what it takes. And it's not just you committing that time. It's everybody around you and your family, your friends, your sponsors have to have that same level of commitment.
Great. You got any other
questions? One last specific one for me, Aaron. You probably knew this was coming, but K&OM, Western Alaska, you know, everyone, as you mentioned, roots for you. I'm just wondering, is there any sort of main message you want to get across that everyone can hear at the same time so that there's no more of this, oh, yeah, well, we read that article in ADN and all of this stuff. But, yeah, what would you like to say to sort of everybody at once if you could?
You know, Western Alaska is my home. I was born and raised here in Nome, but Dad was very influential in the early 70s and setting up the school and the state-run school programs in the villages from St. Lawrence Island to Diomede to all over the 21 villages in this Bering Strait region. I had the honor to travel with Dad back in those days through all those communities and villages as that was being set up. And, of course, Nome was a boarding school at the time, too. And it's every village I enter, even coming down the Yukon River, it's the people are like family. I spent so much time there as a child growing up. Now in construction, I'm working in many of the same communities, and I can't thank the people enough for their trust, for their friendship, for being there, because it's very special. And every community that I enter, from Unicle to Shaktuluk to Caltech, Galena, it's like I've got family there waiting for me, and they're standing there to support me coming through. And it's not just me as a dog musher, but it's as a contractor coming in, as a friend. There's that level of trust there, and there's that friendship that makes me feel at home. And it's something that I hope I'm not the only musher that gets that feeling, but I'm at home everywhere that I travel to. Whether if I'm in a boat in the summertime or flying my plane or on a dog team, I feel at home in every community I'm at. And I've got to thank everybody for the friendships, for the lifetime of advice. And as a young man growing up, the elders would give me advice all the time. People would pull me aside and say, hey, think about this. And it's made me who I am today. And it's really the community in Nome. As a teenager growing up, I would hold fundraisers so I can have enough money to go to the junior Iditarod and stuff. Those fundraisers, those people that came out and supported me, that helped me keep trails in here in Nome as a child, and supported me, have made me who I am. And my goal today is now, through the company and through contracting, is to be able to give back. And when I'm traveling through these villages, it's super special, but I try to leave something for the kids. I try to give words of advice. I try to give them something that will stick with them the rest of their life. And my goal every day when I'm traveling is, if I can make an impression on one person today, that person down the road will make it on one more and then one more. And so I try to always have that attitude, because it improves lives. And I thank everybody in our region for helping me grow up as the young man that I was and into who I am today, and be able to give back to the communities and the people. And it's hard not to cry right now. It's pretty special. And Nome's got my heart. Nome's a place that I love, and my children love it here, and my wife was born and raised here as well. And it's a special place to all of us.
Aaron Burmeister, paying it forward.
Well, thank you so much. really appreciate your time. And Mandy, thank you for being here. And any other things that you want to share at the moment? Or
no, I just want to thank everybody. It's been incredible. And sorry I couldn't bring our victory home to Nome. We've been working at it a long time, and maybe someday we'll be back at it, or maybe come in a different way and support the race or support somebody else to help them get to that level. But it's been a lifelong goal, a lifelong commitment, and we put everything into it. And so we'll keep at it and keep giving back in other ways. Thank you all.
That was Aaron Burmeister with Alaska Public Media's Jeff Chen, recorded at the KNOM studios in Nome, just about a day after Burmeister's finish in his 21st Iditarod. The Iditapod is a production of Alaska Public Media. I'm Casey Grove, and thanks for listening.